afternoon. So, last time, we talked about bootstrapping return-oriented programming. So we learned previously about return-oriented programming, and we saw that we could like chain together these snippets of machine code that we found in an application that typically ended in a return. And the idea is that we just have our stack be basically a little program where each instruction in that program was one of these snippets to run, possibly some what we're going to call arguments for that snippet, which would take the form of values that it would pop off the stack. And this same technique we can also use for things where we don't actually start by overwriting a return address on the stack, but instead we overwrite something else and we just look for some gadget which moves where the stack is so that we can continue on with, you know, looking at the stack and expecting things to be popped from the stack. And this is a very common technique when someone has an exploit in a binary which doesn't allow you to write over to write over the stack and execute the stack at this, you know, usually you just allow writing, you know, where instead, since we can't write things and execute the things we just wrote, we use this to use some overflow we have for any sort of function pointer of any kind, be it a return address or something else, and use this to set up actually running what the attacker wants to choose to run. We also mentioned that, well, you know, you could maybe have a program where we get rid of all the gadgets that involve doing something and returning by just carefully protecting all our return instructions and all the machine code that happens to contain return instructions if you start in the middle of what is intended to be another instruction. And we saw that, well, you know, that's often not going to be enough because we can also do the same kind of thing we did with these gadgets that end in return with gadgets which end in jumps. And sort of the basic trick that proves you can do this on many programs is that we can have this dispatcher where we look for some gadget that basically increments a pointer and jumps using it. And we can use that sort of as glue to chain together a whole bunch of gadgets, even though we don't have something like a return operation, which makes it very convenient to chain together a whole bunch of gadgets. But we can do the same idea of basically writing a program as a list of gadgets using this dispatcher as the way of going to the next gadget rather than relying on every gadget we have ending in a return. So that is our final topic. We looked at address space layout randomization. So this is the idea that we're going to choose random addresses when we reload a program. And this is our primary way of making it more difficult to exploit things like stack smashing and return-oriented programming, that hopefully it will be hard for the attacker to figure out what the address of, say, the stack is for stack smashing or of the various gadgets that make up their return-oriented programming chain. Because that address will be different every time. But there's some limits to that. So one limit is that, especially on systems with smaller address spaces, like 32-bit systems, which used to be pretty common, less common these days, we just don't have that much flexibility in what addresses we can choose. So it turned out on 32-bit systems that often we have around a few hundred choices after we dealt with, well, I have to load it at a multiple of the page size because that's what the hardware supports well. And I have to make sure there's enough room for me to allocate more stack and heap space, you know, and there's only, you know, a 32-bit system, 4 gig to work with in total. So we ended up having, you know, often only a few hundred choices for where something would be placed. And this meant that an attacker could guess and be right too often. On a 64-bit system, this is less of a problem. we also talked about, well, what are we actually randomizing? And we might imagine sort of the ideal would be that we'd randomize the location of like every function and every global variable, but we can't do that. And the biggest practical reason is that when we load an application, we don't want to have to fix up all the addresses all throughout the application. And most of the time, we're going to choose to actually do some very minimal fix-ups. So the usual sort of idea is that if we're loading foo.exe, I should fix the mapping on this slide, we'll have the constants, code, and globals in foo.exe will be separate segments, but they have to stay together because like our code here is going to do something where we use some relative instruction, some relative addressing to access, say, the constants or the globals. And that's because, well, we don't want loading the program to involve changing lots of parts of this code. There's a couple reasons for that. So one is that just that that's slow. Another is that if we have multiple copies of foo, we'd like to give each of them a different random location and still have only one copy of it in memory. And that means that we'd like each copy to not have any of the code actually changed, rather than needing each copy that we load in a different location to have like a separate copy in the real memory. So we're going to finish up talking about ASLR next, but first questions on things we covered last time. Okay, I'm not seeing anything. So a brief scheduling note. So on the calendar, there's no class next Monday because that's a university break day. That means the quiz that will be released for this week will be due next Wednesday. There's still a return-oriented programming assignment that will be released by Friday, probably by tomorrow morning, but I want to make sure I don't discover any issues with the executable I've constructed for that. Okay, so I showed you that on Linux, we have this, is we keep all the code together, all the code and data that we load from an executable together, even though it might be loaded in multiple segments. And that part of why we do this is because, well, we have this relative addressing in this code bit because we aren't willing to make changes there. And we saw with how like library calls work that basically there's going to be some part of this that the linker makes changes to, but we're, for performance, it's going to be limited to basically a single region that the linker is going to change. And that would be our global offset table. Windows made a different choice. So they said, they're willing to edit code to relocate. So some things in Windows use a global offset table like structure, but this is generally just for some things between libraries. But a lot of stuff in Windows that on Linux would have to use relative addressing or do a global offset table lookup doesn't. And instead, Windows has decided they're okay editing code as part of loading an application, even though that's slower. And sort of the main compromise they've done for this is that they've decided that they're going to choose one location per boot for a program or library. So they're going to randomize that location, but they're not going to randomize it every time they load the program, like Linux has chosen to do, but they're going to do it just once because they're going to edit the code and, you know, to choose when they choose that location. So you'll basically end up with a fixed location provided that the library doesn't get unloaded and that Windows doesn't need to have two copies loaded at the same location for some reason, in which case it would two copies loaded at different locations because there's a conflict. Like if one application loads a library at location A and another application loads a different library at the same location, and then it wants to use the first library, then we need to like have two copies of the first library. But other than situations like that, where we can't get away with one fixed location, Windows is going to choose one. So this is, you know, a compromise they made, and it makes ASLR less effective. So one way it makes it less effective is that if you think of a server that restarts, well, you know, you can kind of eliminate the possibilities you've seen before if you're guessing locations. And if you have an information leak from one program on the system, you can use that to exploit a different program if they share a library. And on Linux, because the location's randomized for each time you start a program, that won't work. So questions about the differences here between what Windows has chosen to do and what Linux has chosen to do? So probably a good question is, you know, So a question is, does this mean you could craft a program that loads all of the same libraries as what you want to exploit in order to find their locations? Yeah, so Windows's scheme is not very useful against local exploits, basically. Like if you're on the same system, you can get a lot of information unless Windows were to do something like make exceptions or for a sensitive application, or the sensitive application were to do something special to prevent it. And that is a big disadvantage if you care about having a login to a system and, you know, trying to get more privileges on the same system. Now, this choice to edit code might say, well, in Linux, they just use relative addressing. Like, why doesn't Windows feel comfortable doing that? Well, the problem is that, you know, often there are things we want to do where even when we have instructions that do relative addressing, you know, we'd really prefer to use the absolute version. So for example, a common implementation of a switch statement, you know, might be that we would do a table lookup, for example. So this might be how a switch statement is implemented, by looking up in this table. And the simplest way to have this work would be for the table to contain the addresses to jump to. And that works perfectly fine, but it means that we need to have the address of the lookup table, so the sort of absolute lookup table address, and the absolute addresses of code in the lookup table as part of our code. And if we want instead for this function to be loaded at any address to be position independent, we'd end up with a solution maybe like this. This is sort of commonly what compilers will generate when you say, I need position independent code. And you can see that in order to do relative addressing, we've added more steps, that this was previously one jump. And sort of that's the cost we've paid, is these sorts of extra instructions in order for us to support loading our code at any location. And Linux decided, and most Unix likes have decided long ago, that for libraries that are loaded dynamically, they'll just pay this cost in the library code. And when most Unix-like systems defaulted to having full ASL support for executables, they made the same decision for executables, that yes, they'd rather have executables have code like this, but it's bad for security, and they're willing to pay the cost of the diminished performance. But it is diminished performance, and avoiding this is a good reason why Windows might want to instead have this code, but when the program is loaded, to have the program loader insert the absolute addresses that it chooses in these locations. So there's a question, wouldn't editing the code open up new vulnerabilities? So a concern would be, we wouldn't want this code to be writable for an attacker. And generally our fix for that is that we'll edit the code as we're loading the program, but before we start the program, we're still going to, as usual, set the memory that we're executing as read-only. So I've shown you sort of what the difference is between 64-bit and 32-bit, but to better understand the Windows decision, it's probably better to look at 32-bit x86. And the solution that sort of, for example, Linux used on 32-bit x86 to do position-independent code is that they would require a register be used to hold the address of the global offset table because it was much slower to compute the same address. So there's no RIP in 32-bit x86. You can't do the relative move and load effective address. And if you wanted to do that, you need to do something like have a call instruction and then pop the return address that's pushed, which is way slower. You have to write to memory to figure out where your code is. And the typical Linux solution was that they'd have some code run in advance that put, you know, a base address in EBX, and then they'd use things relative to that, which meant that you just lost a whole register. And on 32-bit x86, where there's only 8 general purpose registers, that's a huge cost. And it meant that the overhead that people observed was bad, and that you really wanted to avoid this for, you know, many, for every program, especially if you cared about performance. So these are the results on a benchmark for CPU performance, and you can see that enabling position-independent executables, so making the executable have all that only position-independent code, the libraries presumably unchanged, meant that suddenly we had between 25 and a few percent overhead. But on 64-bit, I haven't found great results, but it's the overhead's just way lower because the processor support's there. And so this is something where, you know, the instruction set design decisions made a big difference, that the 32-bit x86 instruction set just wasn't designed with position-independent code in mind. And the 64-bit version, when AMD decided to extend 32-bit x86, they realized, you know, we probably should make this easier. And they did, and, you know, it's part of why we, you know, don't feel like it's a big problem to enable ASLR these days. So questions about this idea of position-independent code overhead? So a question is, does Linux by default compile with position independence then? So libraries on Linux And most Unix likes have always been position independent code for, shared libraries, I should say. So libraries that are dynamically loaded have always been position independent code. Programs are different. So in like 2000, pretty much everyone defaulted to having executables have hard-coded addresses, and you just always load them to a fixed location. And later on, they chose to support randomizing their addresses, and I have the sort of the dates I looked up here. It's surprisingly late. So for Windows, Microsoft Visual Studio enabled this by default in Visual Studio 2010. Before that, wasn't enabled. OS X in the compilers they ship since 10.7. And if you look at Linux distributions, it depends which one you're looking at, but, 2015-ish. But the alternative, wasn't that they were editing the code, but that you'd have your executables would have hard-coded addresses, and they just always load at the same location every time. Which, because that was faster. Okay, so questions about position independence. So since we've talked about how ASLR works, I'm going to go over an exploit that happened in sudo. So sudo had a big security flaw earlier this year. And the people who discovered it discovered that not only was there a buffer overflow in sudo, but that they could reliably exploit it despite ASLR. You might say, well, how did that happen? So we're going to look at, this exploit sort of end-to-end, but first we're going to start with what the bug was. So the bug in sudo was that this check here could inadvertently skip over the null terminator of a string. So we could have a string in from and we could have a backslash in it, and then the null terminator, which I guess I'll write for clarity, I'll just draw boxes around each character. And this code here could inadvertently skip over a null terminator. And this was bad because the size of the buffer that was going to be used for this copy, so this is copying from into two, but the size of the buffer allocated for two was based on string len. So there's this disagreement here as far as what the length of this string was, that we had one length from the string len call and another length from iterating over it to find a backslash zero, but skipping any backslash zero that's after a backslash character. So this was something that could be triggered by executing sudo with very particular options. And this was a heap overflow. It's a heap overflow because we have something that's malloced. And the question then is, well, if we can overflow the heap, what's going to be next to this? And you might say, so how did someone trying to exploit this, what are you going to look for? So do you run it in a debugger and see what's next to it on the heap? They used a much sort of more brute force approach. So they just said they trigger this buffer overflow a ton of times. They just wrote a program that triggered it a ton of times, and they looked at how the program crashed. And based on the crash, they figured out, well, when are the cases when something interesting is getting overflowed? And the reason why you do this is that, well, if it crashes, like, what are the possible reasons it's going to crash? So it could be because we sort of overflow into a guard page. So that's kind of a boring one. It could be because we corrupt a pointer that's used. So that seems very useful. We talked about pointer subterfuge, where if you corrupt a pointer, you can maybe use that to write somewhere else. So that would be useful. Could be, and this could be either a data pointer or a code pointer. And so what they're really looking for is, well, we assume that if we do just a random overflow, that we're going to have some cases where, like, it just crashes because we ran into some actually unallocated space that's not accessible. But there's a bunch of cases where it crashes because we corrupt some pointer, and how it crashes will show us which pointer did we end up corrupting. And they found that one of the crashes occurred, looked like this in the debugger, that there was a call to a function pointer. So it looked like they happened to get really lucky and corrupt that function pointer. And this doesn't actually seem like super useful because of ASLR, right? It seems like, great, you're overwriting a function pointer, but the problem is that all the addresses in the application are random. So, you know, how can you figure out what to put in that function pointer? Without some other bug. But there's this trick that often comes up with how ASLR works, which is that we can try to take advantage of where this function pointer usually points. So there's something here where there's some configuration option which determines how sudo gets information from its environment. This is this configurable get env fn. And there's some default setting for that. And by looking in the sudo source code, they figure out, okay, so the normal setting is this function called sudoers hook get env. And that's in this library that's part of sudo called sudoers.so. And they looked at this library and discovered, oh, well, there's some other interesting things in this library too. There's this function execv. And it's part of the same library, so it's going to be loaded together as far as ASLR works, that this whole library is going to be loaded as a chunk. So there's going to be the code for the sudoers hook and the code for execv. And that means that they're always going to be offset, in this case, by exactly 6000 hex. The difference between the two addresses is always going to be exactly that. Also, we know that the operating system needs to load things in pages, which are 4K. So that also means that the last 12 bits of the addresses are always going to be the same. The last 12 bits of the execv address and happens that the sudoers hook get env address are always going to end in A00. Because when we're choosing an address to load at, we keep things aligned in those 4K chunks because that's what the hardware can conveniently load. And this function here, this execv function, so this is a library function to run an executable. So that's why it's interesting. It sure would be bad if an attacker could call this function with anything useful. And because we have this static offset, there's this trick that they noticed you can do. So let's suppose that we've chosen a random address for the hook get env function, this function here, where that function pointer usually points. And let's say, it's this address. Then we can compute what the execv pointer points. And these addresses only differ in these last two bytes. So sorry, in these first two bytes. It's important that these are the first two bytes because of this is little endian. And that means that if we have an overflow of the buffer that goes into this pointer, what you can do is we can just stop here. We just want to overflow two bytes and leave the rest unchanged. Because if we leave the rest unchanged, then it would still work if the pointer was, you know, to a different randomly chosen, you know, address. So the attack is to guess that the address looks something like this and always write these two bytes with our overflow and leave the rest unchanged. And that way, as long as the last 16 bits of the address are AAA in the randomization chosen, you know, we'll end up pointing that function at the execv stub. So my question would be, well, how often does this work? Well, we mentioned earlier that the last four bits of this address are fixed. So the only thing that's actually randomized here is this 8, that we're guessing that there's an 8 there and not something else. So, you know, if we do this overwrite, then there's actually only 4 bits that we have to guess. We're guessing that those 4 bits are 8. And that means that it would seem that we're working 1 out of 16 times. So the exploit is we just keep trying running sudo, triggering this overflow. We overwrite this 003A. And 1 out of 16 times, it's going to work. The other times, there's going to be some other piece of code that we're going to be calling something that's like after or before execv, and it's not going to work. Now, it wasn't quite so good in practice, because they actually needed to have a null terminator in there, but that just meant that they were assuming that not only did we have this 8 here, but you had 2 zeros here. So it was 12 bits that were fixed, which is still that it works 1 in 4,096 tries. That's still plenty good enough for some program you can execute locally. So questions about sort of this trick of overwriting just the first few bytes of the pointer. Well, there's one question is, could this A00 have been something else? Yeah, so this A00 here just happened to be where it ended up in the file based on how much code was around it. And it was just a coincidence that these happened to be a round number of bytes apart. But the same strategy would have worked, say, you know, if this was at, you know, 3A16, we just write a 16 instead of a null there. Other questions? So question is, couldn't you run an arbitrary program if you had sudo access already? So this is a good question. Like, why do we care about being able to run sudo locally? So typically, sudo is a program that's configured to have extra permissions when it runs, because if you enter the right password, it lets you do something. The way that that typically works is that the sudo program is configured to be able to do anything. And we rely on the sudo program behaving correctly in that it's not going to do anything for you unless you enter the right password or similar in order for its security to hold. Okay, so now we have a case where we're running the execv function. So the question might be, well, we're running a function that the program's not intending to call. Why is this useful? So the execv function executes a given program, but we don't get to control the arguments. We're just controlling that the function is running, and the arguments are actually kind of hard-coded, that the call that's being made to sudoers hook getty and v is passing this string systemd bypass user db, like, and we can't change that. But so why is that a problem? Well, the problem is that execv thinks this is the name of the program to run. And well, to make that work, all we need to do is have a program with that name if the OS searches for it. So the exploit is you make a program with that name in the current directory and then, you know, trigger this replacement, and then that program will run, and it will run with the elevated permissions that sudo has. So questions about... this process. So the question is, so this exploit is just password avoidance. So it's probably more than that. So typically, even if you aren't configured to have permission to use sudo, you can still run the sudo application on a typical Linux system. That the Linux system is typically configured so anyone can run the sudo application, and when they run it, it runs with elevated privileges, even if that application, all it's going to do when it, all it should do when it runs is figure out that, oh, you aren't in the list of people who's allowed to use the sudo command. That's a good question, right? So it seems like something we could have done that's kind of, you know, would have made this less likely to happen is somehow restrict access to these, you know, extra privileged applications only to users who actually have a reason to run them. But that's not very typically done on Linux systems, and it's actually pretty hard to configure. Other questions? Follow-ups? Okay. So, I just showed you an example of sort of an exploit where we took advantage of a heap overflow. And we kind of had to do something very application specific. And, you know, they had to do this sort of brute force technique where they looked for what actually gets overflowed and relied on, you know, hopefully the program executes similarly enough each time that they can make that consistent. And they found a way to do it. And we were kind of relying on just, you know, being lucky about two things being adjacent on the heap. And it seems like we didn't have anything that's kind of like stack smashing. Where with stack smashing, you know, we could have taken advantage of like pointers and functions on the stack, but we have this very generic technique where, you know, if we had a stack overflow, we could always turn it into execution. And might ask, well, is there something similar we can do for the heap? And the answer is often has been yes, And as you might imagine, this might be something which is fixed, but historically, at least, just like with stack smashing, there was a very generic way of exploiting the heap, which I'll go through next. So first, a lingering question on the sudo exploit. So shouldn't this have been prevented by a guard page? So yes, so if our malloc, if this malloc that sudo used here put a guard page after the allocation, then yeah, that would have prevented this exploit. And you might say, so why didn't it? And probably the reason why is that the size was not very large and it didn't want to waste space by allocating a guard page for like a 10 byte allocation. But I'm thinking of like how allocations work, we should to think about sort of generic ways that we might be able to exploit overflows on the heap, we need to talk about how malloc and new might work. And there are lots of different implementations of malloc and new with lots of different techniques. But a very common technique that has resulted in many exploits and is still a very attractive technique involves storing things in free space. So we need to store metadata about where available space is. So for example, if I've allocated an object and there's space I've allocated around it, the malloc or new implementation wants to track that space around the object. And a very common strategy for that is to have some sort of data structure in the free space. So here, the strategy is that we have, before every object that gets allocated, we have some information about how big that object is and whether that space is free. And afterwards, we have, and in a free space, we have these two additional fields, which are a linked list of free items. And the idea of this is that we're going to maintain a linked list of the free chunks, and our malloc function is going to scan that linked list for something that's big enough. And the attraction of this is that, well, we're going to have to allocate from the OS probably bigger chunks than we'd like to give to the application. And if I'm calling malloc, 15 to get 15 bytes, the OS, will give you 4K. And I need to track how the rest of that 4 kilobytes is actually used. So if someone calls malloc 15 again, we can give away part of that 4K. I also want to track space that gets freed up so I can reuse it later on. That, for example, here, if this nude object gets freed, I want to do some bookkeeping to realize that, wait a moment, this free space here that was previously this big, now it's this big, and update my data structures accordingly. So the reason why this can create problems maybe problems is arguable, why this is something that would be interesting to an attacker with a buffer overflow. Well, let's think about what's after this nude object. Well, we have this size information and this next and previous pointer, assuming we're lucky enough that the thing after the nude object is free space. And we learned that if you can overwrite a pointer, well, you can often trick the program into using that pointer to change some memory at a location of your choice. And that's exactly what we can do. And to think about how this would work, let's think about what's going to be in the free implementation to do this operation. And note that something we want to do here in that free implementation is we want to remove this item here from the linked list it's in. So first, before I get into that, questions about this scenario. So what question is, why is this nude object here not in the struct? So basically, what we have, conceptually, is that we have two versions of this struct. We have this version here, and we have a second version, which is has the free and size in the same place, and then the data for the object. And when we make an allocation, when we actually have allocated space, we use the second version and return a pointer to this data, and we convert it to this other type when it gets freed. And we figure out which type it is with this free field here. Does that explain what's going on here and sort of why we have this size and free field in the new object and not the other ones? So question, is this data here a pointer or just the object? So this is meant to represent the actual object itself. It's not a pointer of any kind. So in the actual implementation, we probably won't actually have this struct written out. It will just be sort of computed by manipulating memory addresses. Okay, so now that we understand the structs involved and we know that there's this unlinking operation, let's think about what that looks like. So our free implementation, it's going to figure out, well, what's after this block I'm freeing in memory? It's going to check if it's already free. And if so, we're going to have to do that merging operation. And part of that is removing it from this linked list it's on. And a typical way we might do that is with something like this, where we use the previous pointer to update the previous is next to our next. And this here is an arbitrary memory write that we can take advantage of as an attacker and exploit. So this is an example of pointer subterfuge, and it's one that we can get pretty reliably on the heap if we know the malloc in free implementation looks like this. If it looks different, well, this is not going to work. But if we know that you're using this version of free, we can do this reliably. And you might say, well, wait a moment. What in your scenario here, you had free space after the thing we overflowed. So don't I depend on that? And the answer is no, because we can overwrite the free field as part of our overflow. So we can guarantee that this block after free check always passes as long as it's part of our overflow. So we can reliably make sure that when it gets freed, it's going to run this code and do this write using a pointer that we specified. And even better, so this is a pointer we wrote. Attacker could overflow. And it's being written with a value the attacker could have written with the same overflow. So in one step, we've chosen a memory location and a value to put there. So as an example of how you might exploit this in practice, or what it might look like. So here's our vulnerable code. We have a buffer. We have a copy into the buffer that doesn't check whether we copy too many characters. And then we have two free calls. I'll show you why there's two free calls in a second. So first we have our free, and that's going to merge all these three blocks. So we're going to remove this first block up here from the linked list. And we're going to set that up by overwriting, well, past our allocated object and those linked list pointers. And what we're going to set up is that we're going to set up a pointer to shellcode or a gadget we want to use to start return-oriented programming. We're going to set that as our next pointer. And then we're going to set as our brief pointer a pointer to part of the global offset table. And I'm pointing it in this case, I'm pointing it around the address to printf's entry, but that's not actually what I expect to get overwritten, because remember that we're going to interpret this as, one of those structs that represents empty space. So we're looking for where the next field is, and we're saying, well, if the size field is in printf, the brief field's in the malloc entry here, the next field's in the free entry. So this setup ends up over having the free entry be set, because we're going to look at prev next. And we're going to set it to the next pointer to point to that shellcode. So the question is, what's the size free in the middle of the heap? The idea here is that each of these thing chunks that I have a rounded orange box around is one chunk of space that malloc is managing. And it has metadata of a next and a previous chunk of free space, as well as a size. So why is there no previous pointer here, next to previous pointer here? So for allocated objects, we aren't tracking a next or previous item, because these aren't objects that we're going to need to scan for when we're looking for a new space, because it's already allocated. We can't use it right now until it gets free. So the malloc implementation in this case doesn't bother tracking those objects at all, except to have their size available for when they get freed, so they can actually add them to the list then when they'll use this space here to store some pointers. Okay. Other questions about this scenario? So now, if there's something here that's I've kind of glossed over that is that makes this obviously problematic. So can someone, think about that? And, well, it has to do with this next line of code here. So I haven't explained, how we make sure this piece of code works. So that is kind of a challenge here, which is probably more challenging than it used to be now that we have write X or execute, which wasn't the case in sort of the heyday of this technique. And I've shown you overwriting the free entry, and the reason why the attacker would choose to target this free entry is, well, because the next call to a library function is a call to this free function. The question is, would you account for the arrow prev? I'm not sure which arrow prev you're talking about when writing the pointer. So when choosing the address for prev here, we noticed that we didn't actually choose the address that we want overwritten. We chose something that was offset based on where next is. Would I account for the block after prev? I am not sure what you're asking.
Yes, I guess my question is that, like, when you're writing the block after arrow prev, you wouldn't want to do just like the global offset table. You'd want to like account for the arrow prev you'd want to offset printf by the, or that start of printf by whatever like bytes arrow prev adds, right?
So if we look at our struct definition, prev is a pointer already. So prev is the direct address. There's no, the reason we have offsetting is because we think the prev pointer points to a free variable somewhere.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Thanks.
So it's only in this arrow next step. That's where we have to do some offset. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's do I don't actually have a question for this. I already answered that. Okay, so let's do here. So here I have a case where I have A here, which is at address 1000, and the attacker wants to use this to overwrite the value at address 2000 to 3000. And we have this operation here, which copies a attacker controlled string into a buffer in A. This is just a method call. And you have our buffer, we have our unused space, and then we have the size and free mux pointer, prev pointer. And this is sort of what heap objects look like. So how would we take advantage of what our free implementation, in this case our delete implementation, does? And I guess we probably should pretend this is not a string copy, so you can put null bytes in there, which is a detail I missed when writing this question. Let's just assume this is a sort of. A copy into buffer. That overflows. Question, what does override do in C++? It's a way of marking a method as overriding something from a superclass. People, and I do not think this is well understood based on the massive spread of answers I'm getting. So, first thing I want to figure out for this question is, well, where, if we have something being put into the start of buffer, where in the buffer is one of these prev, index, and free? And so note that this when free thing here, this is the layout of the thing right after our my buffer object. So we have here, we have our size plus free, 8 bytes. Then we have a next pointer, 8 bytes. And then we have a prev pointer, which is 8 bytes. And the beginning of the buffer to the end of the buffer, this is 64 bytes. Then we have another 16 bytes. So we get to the next free at 64 plus 16, which is 80 bytes. So I marked up here that if we think about this as the next free object, 80 bytes is where the size and free starts. 88 bytes is where the next pointer starts. And 96 bytes is where the prev pointer starts. And probably, I guess I was hoping for more answers. Are people still working? So a question is, what's after A in memory? So this here is the layout of A. And what's after it is something with this, well, something which could have this layout or could be something similar. But something which is going to be interpreted with this layout because we're going to mark it as free with the size plus free field. Okay, so yeah, Okay, so I'll continue explanation. So if we look, this is the assignment we want to take advantage of. So if we're taking advantage of this assignment, the answer would be different if we were taking advantage of the other assignment that's in the code I showed you. Actually, I shouldn't switch away the code I showed you earlier, but taking advantage of this particular assignment, the value we're going to be storing is block after next. So we want to change the next pointer, so the pointer at 88 bytes after, to the value we want to store, which is this. So this is 88 bytes after the beginning. And then there's kind of a trick question. So you would think, okay, so that means we set the pref pointer to the address we want to write, but that's not true. So we want to actually store that address we put in the pref pointer is going to be interpreted as the base address of one of these free blocks. So we need to have it be offset by 16. So we want to actually store not 0x2000, but a little less than that as our pref value, which would be 96 bytes after. So the question is, isn't it offset by 8 since it's 8 bytes in? I'm assuming that our pointers are all to the size field and not to the next field, though both would be things that you could see done by a malloc implementation.
I guess my question is that, like, doesn't the next pointer start 8 bytes in? So if you wanted to offset to the next pointer, you would just subtract 8 bytes and not subtract 16.
Sorry, you're right. I was thinking wrong. So yes, the next pointer starts 8 bytes in. Sorry, yes, you're right. I was measuring the wrong distance. So 8 bytes there. So we put this 2000 minus 8, 96 bytes after. So questions on how I came up with this answer, since of those who answered the poll, there is clearly no consensus. Also, this 0x1000 value is completely unnecessary. It doesn't affect what we do. It might be nice to know, but it's not really actually particularly something we need to use. So questions about how I figured this out? Can I explain this subtraction here? So the pointer pref here is pointing to one of these free objects at the beginning here. It's pointing to the size field of one of the free objects because that's the first thing in that struct I showed you earlier. And that means if we want to access the next field of that particular struct, we need to advance by 8 bytes. So I did the opposite of that in choosing the value for pref. So after we do this next computation, I end up with this 20000 address. Does that explain things? Further questions, clarification? And I guess it's worth saying that this issue also comes up on the subterfuge assignments. So where you have a pointer that's, we're going to access something using that pointer that's not at the exact location it points to, but somewhere later. That's very common. Okay. So that's on heap overflows, unless there's more questions. Okay, so there's another common exploit that occurs with heap allocations that doesn't involve buffer overflows at all. And this is something where the pattern might look like this, where we allocate an object foo, and somehow the object foo gets deleted, and then we allocate something else, but still try to use the deallocated object foo. And you might say, well, this is going to crash, right? This is a seg fault? Well, and sometimes it is. And for security reasons, we probably hope that it was always a seg fault, but in practice, this is not true because of, well, the whole reason why we see these malloc implementations tracking blocks of free space is because they want to use them again. So this allocation of bar here could get lucky and happen to use the same space that foo previously used. And therefore, this call to a method of foo could actually end up working. Well, working. And, well, what's this call going to do? One thing it might do is it might be using a vtable. And if bar got to use the same space that foo was previously in, maybe it will end up pointing some other place. Maybe this is, you know, the big concern is, you know, if the attacker, you know, can control this. Like if this is like a buffer to hold an attacker's string that happens to be allocated in the same space, that this is something that can be exploited. And this is one of the most common types of memory mismanagement exploits these days, because we've gotten a better handle on avoiding buffer overflows. And you might say that this scenario here is unrealistic, and it is, because, well, you know, if we're deleting foo, obviously we're not going to use it again. The typical ways this actually happens is that, like, we'll have a, current foo, we'll have some other pointer that we stash the value of foo in, and we'll use that pointer. And that's the reason why this confusion happened in the first place, that the programmer forgot that this copy of this foo pointer, you know, existed. And so they thought that it was okay to delete the original, and then something can use the copy. And that's typically how this happens in practice. And often the attacker can give some unusual commands to deliberately trigger the scenario where, you know, one command will end up deleting the original and another command will use this copy that was saved earlier. Now, it does seem like the attacker needs to get awfully lucky for this to happen, but the attacker has a lot of flexibility. And commonly to exploit this sort of thing, you know, the attacker might, you know, try to repeatedly trigger there to be these dangling pointers so they get lots of chances. And, you know, we'll try to do lots of allocations, you know, they can try, you know, they can trigger lots of bars to be allocated and hope that one of them works out. Yeah. So in real scenarios, they often have a lot of flexibility. A classic example of where this happens is a lot of browser exploits have been use after free bugs. And a reason why the attacker has the flexibility to do this sort of thing is that you can write JavaScript code that tells the browser to do particular things. And, you know, that JavaScript code, you know, can trigger these things in a loop, basically, you know, which could be very handy for your, you know, making sure that this scenario happens much more reliably. So we'll finish up, we'll talk about use after free exploits a little more next time, including going through an example. And then we'll start talking sort of in earnest about sort of more sophisticated ways of mitigating both overflows and other types of exploits that we've seen so far. So before I sign off, any questions about things we covered today?
Thank you.